This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, pardes.org.il, for helping make this class happen. Okay, everybody. Good morning. We left off with, I think, a decent picture of Rashi. And as I recall, the last 15 minutes of class, I realized I had more time. So we began to speak about the Second Crusade, the second and the third, and the major shift that happened between the classic Ashkenaz, the sort of formative culture that was rooted in the cities of what we call Kirat Shum, right? Spires, Worms, and Mainz, right? And a shift which began to happen from there into a broader culture of the Tosafists. So we're going to, today what I want to do is basically paint a little bit of a broad picture of the 12th century and what was happening in Europe as a whole, insofar as that's possible, at the very least in France, Germany, right, where the center of Jewish culture remained. So we'll take a picture, we'll take a look at that. I call that the making of the Jew. And we'll speak about why that is. And then I want to delve into the two major intellectual and cultural movements in the Jewish world of that time, which is the Tosafists and Hasidei Ashkenaz. So that's the plan for today. Ready or not, here it comes. So we spoke about the nature of the relationship. Well, step back a second. Why is this, in my mind, called Making of the Jew? It's actually quite important to remember, and it is a personal pet peeve of mine, as my children can tell you, there were no Jews in the Bible, right? Not only were there no Jews in the Bible, there were really Jews in the Second Temple period, but there was not yet a Judaism, as we've spoken about, in the sense of an ism, which is a unified, agreed-upon standard of measure of who is in and who is out. That's a much more modern problem. As we spoke about in earlier phases of the class, you know, as long as there was a national vessel, as long as there was not even independence, but simply that the borders of Judea existed, that the temple stood, or at least in its immediate aftermath, right, that there was a center around which many diverse groups of people could identify themselves as the Jews. Remembering, of course, that the word Jew has its roots in what word? Judea, is Judah. So first it's tribal, which then becomes geographic. And you should never forget, who's the first person to be labeled as a Yehudi? It's coming up. Mordechai, who of course was from what tribe? Benjamin, right? So it's a very important part of the Megillah, is that the Megillah actually exists at that crux point when the tribal geographic boundaries of the First Temple period were being transformed into these sort of cultural, ultimately religious boundaries that the Second Temple period produced. And when the Second Temple falls, and Hadrian, Yamach Shemo, decides to take his revenge on the Jewish people by erasing Judea from the map, literally, right? By changing all the maps of the Roman Empire no longer to read Judea, but rather what? Palestina. Right, which proves to be a fairly effective tactic to this very day. But the Jews don't disappear. It's just that it used to be before the Third Roman War, when you saw someone and said, "What are you?" "I'm a Jew." "Where are you from?" "Well, Judea, duh." Right? Now, as we move out into the Middle Ages, "Oh, what are you?" "I'm a Jew." "Where are you from?" "Regensburg." Right? Even the Jews don't associate that title any longer with geography. It's true, there is a memory of where we are from. We see ourselves as an exile. And remember, exile is bound up with a memory of where you're from. Never forget that. Exile is defined by the sense that you belong other than where you are. As soon as you feel that you belong where you are, on some level you are no longer in exile. Ask my American students. They are no longer in exile. Even the softened term of diaspora does not appeal to them anymore, right? They are from where they're from, right? Exile is the state of being, believing where you are other than where you belong. And the Jews of Europe certainly felt that, and should they forget it for even a slight moment, the non-Jews around them would be more than happy to remind them, right? Yes?
Question. You said before that there weren't Jews, whatever. So could somebody just say, if you lived in Judea and parents weren't Jewish, but
Ah, that's a very important question.
So when did it start?
So
father, mother,
it's worth it to go into this a little bit because I think it's important because the point I'm making is that the thing we know as Jew in the Ashkenazi world is really a product of the Middle Ages. Right? This is the process of the making of the Jew. Now, its roots are Judea, Judah, tribal, geographic. But then, David, yes? Good. David's raising a good question, which is like, wait a minute, if at one point Jude meant from Judea, what if this person was not halachically a member of Israel? Well, this should sound familiar, right? Because what if a young soldier whose mother is not Jewish but immigrated from the former Soviet Union, you know, fights and dies, God forbid, in the wars of Israel as a citizen of the state of Israel, and then when it comes time to be buried, he discovers that he's not Jewish? What do we do with that? So I imagine the same question has always existed. And if you want, you can look back. Who was the original convert? No, not only she was the right Ruth. Now, if you look closely, Ruth is famous for saying what? Right. Although you skip the first stage, right? Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. I believe that, not so subtly, that is three layers or dimensions of shared identity. Geographic, where you go, I will go. And if you look in the Hebrew Bible, in the Tanakh, it seems that was the primary definition, not the sole, but the primary definition. Like, these are the boundaries of Israel. I am the king of Israel, and you are in my boundaries. And that's why you don't see such an issue up until the Second Temple period of what we call intermarriage. Now, there's what's called an Isser Chatnu. It's forbidden, but it wasn't the sociological, cultural issue that it is today. Right? Yeah?
It's an incident where there's somebody whose
father wasn't his father is not an Israelite, his mother is. That's a tribal issue. They don't say he's not a Jew. He says that you don't belong to our tribe, you don't belong to our tribe. It's true. I'm not saying, but as a social issue, it doesn't exist. So you have the geographic, and then you have the familial, your people are my people, which is a big part of the Second Temple period. If you read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah in particular, which are the record of the return to Zion last time, genealogy plays a very important role. Right? It's very clear that the familial descent is becoming a dominant factor because the geographic has been confused by exile. And then finally, ultimately, with the destruction of the Second Temple, there emerges the truly religious definition, which, though it may seem to be still familial in the terms of matrilineal descent, in the end of the day, because conversion becomes a real possibility, then actually it shows that it's not in any way familial. Meaning anybody can join as long as we as the gatekeepers are willing to accept their process. That's what I said. So the beginning of the Second Temple period is when the concept of intermarriage, I'm sure it's always existed, and like Shelley's pointing out, we even have evidence for you know, incidents previous, but as a social cultural issue, it belongs to the beginning of the Second Temple period. And has been a question ever since. Yeah? Absolutely. Oh, for sure. They were in touch with them many times, depending on the degree of literacy and, you know, and rabbinic status. So the parallel stories is one of the great challenge of this time period. Last year we spent a good amount of time speaking about this time period in Spain. So this year I've chosen to follow it through in Ashkenaz. We may go back to Spain. I'll get a straw poll from people and we'll logistically. But if we do, it's not going to be until sort of like the late spring or maybe next year. But for now, when I say the making of the Jew, I'm specifically speaking about this Ashkenazi concept of the Jew. So then, once you remove the geographic, right, and the familial and legal, halachic, become the defining characteristics of the Jew. Jew's not from Judea. A Jew is someone who is either part of the clan or adheres to the law. Remembering that I've defined the rabbinic project as, in part, an attempt to get a one-to-one relationship between law and identity, that a Jew is what a Jew does, right? We add to this in Europe a very strong external mold. And we've put a lot of those pieces in place. We've spoken about Augustine, we've spoken about him repeatedly, and this idea of a suffering remnant, and or what he calls the witness doctrine, and how the church, in his eyes, needs the Jews for their own theology, and so therefore they're held alive in place, but in a degraded and subordinate state. We've spoken about the making of the Jew within feudal society, right, which begins as the sort of liquid commercial element when Charlemagne, or really his father Pippin, the short, right, invites them over the Alps, and they begin to play this very important role within feudal society of a liquid element of a society that is bound mostly up in land. And remember that the Jew, of course, is also serf of the king. So we add to that the church's relationship to the Jew is as a witness meant to be degraded but not destroyed. The economic system's relationship to the Jew is as commercial element. In the early Middle Ages, it was a very important bridge between East and West, something which we talked about shifts as the first crusade gets off the ground, and the bridge between East and West culturally is held now by the Europeans, in particular by the Italian city-states, and so that the importance of the Jew as commercial bridge between East and West is lessened. And then what did I say? What commercial role did the Jew then begin to move into? Or not commercial, what economic role? Finance, money lending, because that was a much easier avenue once there was harsh competition for the commercial mercantile, right? The church had suppressed money lending to the degree that it could amongst Christians, and therefore the Jews could step easily into that role. Plus, it's fairly obvious why the commercial and the financial would reinforce each other there. If I deal in goods and services, I happen to have cash, unlike people who are large landholders, and therefore that cash serves as easy capital for investment or simply loans on interest. Right, and that's a very important role that the Jews will play from the Second and Third Crusades, and for a good part of the next 600 years. Again, I do want to stress that numerically the Jews were never the majority of moneylenders. It's just that culturally they were held up as the paragon of the sort of the parasite. In fact, as we saw that letter from Bernard of Clairvaux, if you remember, that he calls moneylending Judaizing. So the church has us as the degraded witness. The economic system has it as the liquid element, which is powerful but precarious, because as we saw in the story of the last week, we spoke about the destruction, the massacre at York. And you remember, that's actually where we ended. The internal Jewish story of the massacre of York was martyrdom. And we're going to come back to martyrdom in this discussion today. What was the external story William of whatever, who told this story? William of Newburgh, who told the story from the English perspective. How did he understand it? But that was how the Jew. No, we haven't. You're talking about William of Norwich. We haven't gotten to him yet. This was the massacre at York, which the Jews saw. You know, on the great Sabbath, Rabbi Yom Tov stood and slaughtered 60 souls, and all the others slaughtered. Those who commanded that they should slaughter their only sons, whose foot could not tread upon the ground, from their delicacy and tender breeding, right? That was the internal Jewish narrative, martyrdom. How did William of Newburgh, who is an English historian, understand it? What was it?
That the Jews owed money, or people had borrowed from the Jews.
The nobles had borrowed from the Jews, and it was a great way to erase their debts. Furthermore, the crusaders who were on their way to the Middle East needed cash, and what better way to pay to redeem the sepulcher from the infidel than to soak the Jews who killed their Lord to begin with. Remember that the first crusades, the Jews paid for the crusade with their blood. The second crusade, they paid for with their cash. And that's just how you can remember it in a somewhat grim fashion, right? So that's the Jew in the church's eyes, the Jew in the economic system, and last, in the political system of feudalism, remember the agricultural military complex, right? That the Jew is the serf of the king. Right? And that's why, as we'll see going forward in European history, the Jew will always be close to absolute power and will be unsafe in a multipolar world. So in the struggle of European history, which the political struggle of European history is defined by the struggles between the nobility, the monarchy, and the church. And you'll get the sort of the common class poking their nose into that struggle more and more as modernity progresses. But at this point of the High Middle Ages, which is what our period is called, right? It's, I mean, this is the, in 1215, the Magna Carta, the first restriction by the nobles on the monarchy of England is written, right? And so this is the time period in which the fierce battles about power are going on between the monarchy and the nobility and the church as well. Well, this, like I mentioned, the Second Crusades were much kinder to the Jews. Much kinder to the Jews. One could say it's because what's the point of, you know, you can't get blood from a stone, right? So what's the point of trying to fleece poor Jews? The other answer is that economically and socially and politically speaking, this is not a democratic society. There was always the big Jew or the Parnassim, right? The economic and political leaders of the community. Who would either, well, protect, sounds like it was voluntary, but generally they would cough up, you know, and that would kind of cover a multitude of sins, as we say. Yeah?
I have a more general question throughout this period.
Uh-huh.
And that is, do we have any sense of how many Jews there were in different parts of Europe? Because if you work backwards,
so at the beginning of the First Crusades period, the best scholarship I've seen puts the number of Jews in classic Ashkenaz, meaning the Rhineland, at about 20,000 people, most of whom are scattered in very small units throughout the countryside. Urbanization actually only begins now in the 12th century. Urbanization, the 12th century, so we have a picture of the pieces, which I want you to hold, in the making of the Jew. We have the church's relationship, that's the suffering remnant doctrine. We have the economic relationship, moving from the mercantile to the financial and the role of moneylender, remembering that the most Jews who lent money were not Isaac of York, who were shelling out diamonds to Prince John, but were rather the small, petty loan, what is it called, pawnbroker, who will give a farmer, you know, a few copper pieces to hold on to the one candlestick that he owns. Right? It's a misconception based in literature that all moneylenders are rich. Then there's the political, which is within the feudal system, the Jew is the serf of the king, remembering that feudalism, as is true of all societies, it was just more blatant, everybody has their role. And you can't move between them. Right? This is the era at which if a person should happen to become wealthy but are not of noble birth, it would be completely scorned by the nobility in hopes of entering. Unless, of course, what can they do? Buy land and then receive a title. Then you can, that is called social money laundering. To this day, right, it's social money laundering. I made all that money, it doesn't matter. Oh, suddenly I have a postage stamp size of land and a manor on it, and they call me, you know, Duke so-and-so. Oh, well, now we'll marry his kids, right? Okay, so that's like the background picture. There's another very important piece, well, before we get to it. Another, in the social cultural currents of Europe, the 12th century, there's something called the Renaissance of the 12th century. Right? There was a tremendous increase in knowledge. It's bound up with also an increase in commercial activity. If people are familiar with the Hanseatic League, this is the period of which the Hanseatic League was really forming in Northern Europe and in Germany and were creating a commercial and defensive empire. And it had a lot to do with what's called the High Middle Ages. We're in the High Middle Ages, right? And there will be, at the end of the 13th century, a series of disasters culminating in the Black Plague, which will take the advance, they call it the High Middle Ages instead of the Middle Ages, because, first of all, it's hard to say, and second of all, because culturally, Europe sort of peaked in around the end of the 13th century and then took a nosedive until early modernity, and by culturally, you know, and also politically in its organization. So this is the High Middle Ages, and because of that, this birth of knowledge is going to have a deep impact on, again, on the making of the Jew. What is the intellectual current of this time, anybody know? The intellectual current. First of all, where does the intellect reside in Europe at this point? In the church. And not just in the church, by the way, in the monasteries.
Well, wasn't this the period of Scholastic?
Excellent. That's exactly what I was looking for. This is the period of scholasticism. So first of all, just picture monasteries. I'm sure some of you guys have traveled in Europe, right? And the monasteries often look like exactly what they were, which was islands of order in the midst of barbarism. Chaos is a little bit too kind. So the monasteries held a monastic order that had a disciplined lifestyle. They also held a lot of knowledge. It wasn't just for fun that the monks made beer and grew their own food. It was also for survival, and therefore a lot of the more advanced knowledge of how to do such things resided within the monasteries. The church also was less than generous in sharing things like literacy, right? The Bible remains the Vulgate, which is the Latin translation. If you recall, we spoke about Jerome and the Vulgate once upon a time in our class, and which is completely unavailable to, I don't know percentage-wise, but let's just say the vast majority of Catholics in Europe at the time, which means that the church not only holds the keys of the sacraments, right, that is a very important part of Catholicism of the Middle Ages, that the sacraments, the acts which a ordained priest can do, communion, right, extreme unction upon death, confession, these are the way that your soul gets into heaven. And you have to try to get your head into a medieval mindset, which is probably not an invitation you get too often, right? But it can be very difficult for sort of people of our time to really appreciate the tremendous reality of spiritual gatekeepers, right? That if you sin and you fear the way in which, there's a reason we say it was such a medieval approach to religion, you fear hell. The solution to your fear is in the hands, not of the church doctrine, not of a loving God, right, but of the priest, who before he will give you communion and hear your confession, has expectations of behavior. Without getting cynical, assuming that this is a good person who actually has your best interests at heart, which I imagine many of them really were, despite the way it's often portrayed in literature, right? But what my point is that the monks, in their knowledge and the priesthood in general, held a tremendous lock on the gates of knowledge and spiritual salvation in Europe of its day, right? And so when I say the intellectual current of Europe, it was primarily in the church. And even within the church, we'll speak about humanism as we go forward. But scholasticism first. So scholasticism, it was a result. What is scholasticism? Scholasticism So Thomas Aquinas is probably the essential personality, as it were, right? This is the age of the birth of universities, right? Universities, all of which had their origin in not just the church, but usually in certain monastic orders. I have an interesting note here that the University of Bologna is usually considered the first true university. It was founded in 1088, followed by the University of Paris and the University of Oxford within 100 years. I didn't know Oxford was that old, right? They're pushing 1,000. This is interesting is that the University of Bologna adopted an academic charter that guaranteed the right of a traveling scholar to unhindered passage in the interests of education, which is the origin of the concept of academic freedom, right? It's very interesting that the concept of academic freedom is born within the High Middle Ages, that there is some intrinsic value to education which trumps all of the other, not all probably, but many of the other social, political, cultural considerations, which were all about power, of controlling sort of freedom of passage and knowledge, etc. So that's just kind of an interesting factoid. But what develops out of these universities, or even produces them, is an approach to text and religion which is called scholasticism, right? It's about conceptual analysis, right, and the careful drawing of distinctions. Right? It moves away from the mysticism that had been inherited from sort of the early Middle Ages into something which appears much more logical, for lack of a better term, to the modern mind. You take a topic drawn from tradition, you broach it in the form of a question, you hear the opponent's responses, counter proposals are argued. Right? This is a very familiar type of discourse. Right? And it's heavy on intellectualism and is pushing against what we would say the mystic irrationalist traditions. So that's going to have a big impact on the continuation of our story, but I just want you to know that Scholasticism in the background, interestingly enough, Thomas Aquinas, who becomes known as a doctor of the church, is a very high elevation, is the sort of leading personality of Scholasticism in the 12th century, and he inherits whose philosophy underlay? It was Aristotelian philosophy. And how did Aristotelian philosophy get to the church of the High Middle Ages? So there are three avenues. One, don't forget that the largest city in Europe at this point is Byzantium. Byzantium, Constantinople. And they still speak Greek there. So meaning in the library at Byzantium, Aristotle was an open book. There's a bit of a misconception that Aristotle was lost to the Christian world. Aristotle was lost to the Western Christian world. That's one avenue. The other avenue is through Avicenna and Averroes, who were two Muslim, not both Arab, because Avicenna was Persian, and he was hence in Persia, right? And Averroes, who was in the Iberian Islamic world, who are both thinkers who wrote extensive commentaries on Aristotle. But for our story, last and certainly not least, the works of Maimonides, who the Rambam is the great Jewish thinker who adopted Aristotelian philosophy, and is at this point, through his works, and also interestingly through Ibn Gabirol, that the certain thoughts of Greek philosophy made their way into the hands of the church. So there is something within Scholasticism, as we'll see, which is a sort of an interreligious conceptual shift. We're going to speak about Maimonides a little bit more, perhaps when the time is right. But I'm just trying to lay the groundwork here. Those are all the pieces. Yeah, I think those are the pieces for now. Question for this, so like the general picture before we start to go into the actual Jewish story. Yeah?
The library in Alexandria is from late antiquity.
Actually, it begins in the ancient world, but I don't think it makes it past late antiquity. I don't know who we blame for destroying the library at Alexandria. That's a Google question. Mm-hmm. But it was gone by now. The relationship between Averroes and Maimonides is a very controversial relationship, which I encourage you, I have a podcast on it if you want to listen to it. Averroes becomes synonymous with heresy in the church of the Middle Ages and amongst the Jews as well. It's a very big part of the story of the development of Iberian Jewish culture, but I can't go into it right now because we're in Ashkenaz.
Where did, as you say, all the manuscripts and the monasteries, where did these manuscripts come from? What did they copy?
Where were the originals from?
All the Greek.
So like I said, there are three avenues. The library in Constantinople, they've been copied by the monks. The Crusaders brought much of that knowledge back to Western Europe, so both from there and potentially from the Arab world. The Toledo Translation School, which is an interesting thing to look up if people are interested in it. Ooh, if I'm not mistaken, it's 11th century, but you can check me on that, in Christian Spain. I can check my notes because it's not at the tip of my fingers right now, but one of the kings of Christian Spain got it in his head that it would be a great idea to translate all the great works of humanity into Latin and Arabic. And since many of the Jews, so many of the people who had were bilingual in Arabic and Latin were Jews, much of it also made its way into Hebrew as well. And so therefore some of the Hebrew script made it. Meaning he wasn't so interested in what the Jews had to say, but the Jews were the linguists of his day. So they played an important role in the Toledo Translation School. Yeah. Scholasticism, yeah.
Scholasticism.
Yeah, and the Toledo School was like an actual effort to make that happen, which had tremendously far-reaching consequences for the culture of Europe. Okay, other questions before we move into the Jewish side of things? Okay, so there is one more unfortunate piece that we need to discuss, and that is the blood libel. Because the Second Crusade takes off in 1147. In the year 1144, we have the first recorded incident of the blood libel. Now, I say of the blood libel, because the reality is that the idea that the Jews are somehow associated with occult, which in human culture in general tends to be associated with blood, and particularly in Christian culture, right? Meaning because not all human cultures see the occult as bad, but you know, Christianity has a big problem the Jews have as well. You know what it is? Evil. Any monotheistic religion has to deal with the problem of theodicy. It's much easier to be an idolater, because then you just divide the world up, even if you're a Manichaean, meaning you just split the world into the evil and the good. So then, like, everything falls into line, right? You can pick what team you're on, but, like, it's very neat. Like, evil over here, good over there, and everything makes sense. It's only once you insist that there's a one God that things fall apart. So you will see in both cultures a sort of constant drift toward dualism. In Judaism, we spoke about it extensively last year with the reemergence of the mythic thinking in the Zohar in the Iberian Peninsula in the 13th century. But for our purposes, Christianity in Europe finds an excellent way to deal with this problem, because, you know, blaming everything on the devil sounds good, but it's a little bit too abstract. You know what you can do, which is a lot more concrete? You can blame it on the Jews, right? Some things never change. So we see the first emergence of this idea of the sort of like nexus between the Jews' blood and evil around ritual and sort of like the negative image of religion. And by negative image, I don't just mean bad, but I mean in the sense of photography. You know, once upon a time, right, we all remember that there were negatives, right? If I make this sound to my kids, they don't know what I'm doing. They're like, what are you doing? I want you to keep that in mind, that sort of negative image, because don't forget the origins of Christianity are in the rejection of the carnal nature of physical Israel. Right? Remember, Christianity's origins are in claiming to be spiritual Israel, who has replaced physical Israel. We spoke about how Augustine proposed a theological sort of like context within which the physical could continue to survive, but it will never be elevated to a positive, right? And you know what the most visceral expression of your physical being is? Blood. Blood, right? Everybody knows, we use it in our language, right? They're like, it's my life's blood, or, you know, in imagery of ritual blood is power, right? And so here in the High Middle Ages, we've already seen one place where blood became a tremendous expression of power in our story. Recently we saw it. What was it? Dove, you brought it up. Yeah. I mean, you made the connection. Martyrdom. Right? We had this question, why was it that classic Ashkenaz was the first culture we've seen basically since the end of the Second Temple where self-slaughter was suddenly elevated to an act of religious piety, where on the surface of it, it should have been forbidden. Meaning it's one thing to choose to die instead of converting. That we expect you to do. But to slaughter your children with a ritual knife that you'll say a blessing over? That seems a little extreme. Right? But what you're doing is maintaining the power of spilling blood. And that has become a base of classic Ashkenazi culture, as we spoke about. Martyrdom becomes a rallying point for the culture of Ashkenaz, in the elevation of the rabbinic class, in that very basic notion, if they were willing to die for it, then we should be willing to live for it. And also in the ability to maintain power in the face of overwhelming odds, right? You can take my body, you'll never have my soul. And even though you think you're right, you sort of Christian crusader, you know, murderers, you know, I get the last laugh because my body's down here and I'm the highest place of heaven. And you know, and so that power, control of your own blood. It's interesting that at this point in history, transubstantiation as a word is actually coined. Anybody know what transubstantiation is? Yeah, as a word, not as a concept, obviously. What is transubstantiation?
The wine or the wine of the sacrament.
The wine and the wafer, both. Right, right. The idea that one of the central sacraments of Catholicism is communion. Right. It goes back, by the way, those of you who are familiar with early Second Temple literature, to the idea of communion meals, which we see good evidence of in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Furthermore, you can see their remnants within Jewish tradition. You also, you know, my personal favorite thought is when Melchizedek comes out to greet Avraham in Bereishit, he brings him bread and wine. So we see in human culture of this region that those that was the lifeblood of relationship. So anyway, the church transformed this into a sacrament, which it believed through the agency of the priest became the actual body and blood of their Savior. Now, this later will become a big split within the church. No, well, we spoke a little bit about the fact that, listen, martyrdom is a great short-term strategy for religions. Bad long-term one, right? Because of the power of the assertion of the kingdom of God within. And so if you really want to see the parallel to the Jewish martyrdom story and the Christian martyrdom story, it's not now, because now Christianity is a majority culture. Majority cultures don't tend to seek martyrdom. They tend to kill other people. Let's just remember that, right? Martyrdom is the strategy of the weak, so to speak. But go back to late antiquity and the story of the 10 martyrs in our tradition, through which marked the 3 Roman Jewish wars, and the sort of birth of Christianity in the suffering under the Diocletian, the persecutions, and even under the Flavians in their later stages. That's like late antiquity. I would call it early late antiquity, if there's such a term. But for now, So the martyrdom opens up this. Just imagine, by the way, the Crusaders, who were, by the way, quite bloodthirsty, pun intended. But imagine their shock when they bust out the doors and they came raging in, ready to force these Jews to kiss the cross or take the sword, and there's just blood everywhere. Now, they came to kill, but I can imagine, nevertheless, the shock. And then what next? The disgust. Who would do that? Nobody is going to be impressed. Well, maybe a few people might be. But nobody's going to say, gosh, maybe we shouldn't have done this if we pushed them to that level. Not at this stage of history, right? And so that blood raises a deep question about the Jews. Like, who would? And by the way, it's a real question. Who would do that? Then we have the rise of this notion of transubstantiation. Again, not as a concept, because that is a very old concept within the church and even predates the church, but as a word to deal with what becomes a theological controversy. Does it literally become? Just think about it for a second. That means that this is ritual cannibalism. Just remember that a person who literally believes that the wafer and the wine become flesh and blood is engaging in ritual cannibalism of a sacred type. I'm not saying that in a mocking or disparaging way. I'm just pointing out the actual reality of that belief. That's what it is. And it becomes a breaking point within the church. It's part of the whole Protestant Reformation precursors to it is breakups around, conceptually, culturally, around. But now what do you have? The central sacrament of the Catholic Church at this point is drinking blood. Drinking blood. Associated with a wafer as well. So now the stage is set. And in 1144, the body of a young boy is discovered in a marsh outside of the town of Norwich. Right? The story emerges that he was snatched and murdered in a ritual fashion by the Jews, who used his blood in their own sacraments. I don't actually have in my notes here, I did in my notes, yes. I wasn't sure if it was already clear by now that it had been linked to Pesach, but yes, he was ritually murdered, accused in the home of Eleazar just days before Passover for his blood, right? And this is the first recorded incident of the notion that the Jews used the blood of a Christian child for the preparation of the Passover matzah. Now, in the context of what I just told you, one might think that this is not so strange. Meaning, you just told me, O priest, when I came to decide whether I'm going to convert to your religion, that the high point of my religious life will be when you let me eat flesh and drink blood. And now you're out there persecuting the Jews because of their desire to drink blood. Right? The parallel there is just a little bit too strong not to contemplate. And I don't have an answer for you except insofar as how I began, which is that there is in the human psyche, especially in the religious psyche, a need to deal with the problem of evil. Right? And it's closely linked with the notion of power. Right? What do I mean? Is that the real problem of evil, I already said, well, you'd think that the problem of evil is the just theodicy, how bad things happen to good people. But you know what the real problem of evil is? You say it slightly differently. How could a good God let bad things happen to good people? Which means that either God is incompetent or uncaring. So power is bound up with the question of evil, which is why the rhetoric of the church, especially at this period of time, is that the devil rules this world. If you look into Civis Dei, into the City of God, the 4th century book by Augustine, which sets the theology of the Middle Ages, you'll see this notion that there's a city of God and there's the other city, so to speak, right? And the team on the other city are basically demons embodied in flesh. And the whole quest, so to speak, of humanity is to create a culture in which the city of God can actually come to rest on earth, right? So the question of who holds power, just look at the image. The Jews are weak, so we can't blame them for being evil because they don't have enough power. But who do they prey on? Children, the even weaker, right? In order to get what? To get their blood, which is the essence of life, in order to use it for their ritual, because don't forget in the background, it's a fight over whose God, or sorry, not whose God, because the same God, whose story is right. Who's telling the right story about what God wants to get to redemption? And Easter and Passover, which of course are in the calendar quite closely linked, are also theologically linked. Easter is a celebration of what? The resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, which sort of is the crux point of the Christian assertion of his divinity. And Passover is the celebration of what? You see, I'm sorry, which is on a level the resurrection of Am Yisrael from slavery to freedom, right? And which is, of course, the crux point that God intervenes in history, that we haven't just been put on the planet and things are just playing themselves out. You see the strong parallels here? So the control of power in that moment is very important. Mitzitza Bepe. This we could go a lot of directions with the power of blood, and I don't think I want to do it because actually I've gone further on this perhaps than I should have. Just it's of interest to me, so I'll leave it as a good question. No. Gerald, no. You're good with those questions though, but I want to try to actually as contrary to usual be a little bit linear today. So the blood libel is not going away. I mean, I can tell you that my great-great-grandfather was dragged to death behind a wagon on Easter Day in Romania at the turn of the 20th century for a blood libel, right? And yes. I heard the story from my great-aunt who actually watched it happen. What's the word I'm looking for? Psychodrama, which will periodically play itself out, right, cannot be undervalued, meaning the average person, even today, but certainly then, lives with a great fear of the ignorance that they hold and the darkness of the world around them. And, right, the one way that we deal with that is through things like scholasticism, which is an attempt at knowledge and rationalism and the ability to put the world in order. The other way we do it is through an attempt to hold power. And the reality is there are basically two avenues to the same goal, right? Knowledge is power, right? But so is magic, right? And this idea that there are unseen forces to which we can sacrifice and from which we can demand is something that is deeply rooted in the human psyche. And through many cultures of humanity, blood has played an essential role. And so it is not an accident in my eyes that at this point where the Jew has now taken full form within European society and is very easily cast now as the inverse, in the sense negative, of right religion. Right. Furthermore, I mean, it's just so ripe. Right. They speak funny language. They actually look different, and we haven't gotten to it yet, but the Jewish badge laws are a product of the early 13th century when Jews, it starts, begins to be mandated that Jews wear, you know, like funny hats and yellow badges. That was not a product of Nazi Germany. We'll speak about it soon enough. And so not only that, they speak foreign languages. They use these Kabbalistic-looking scripts, right? And so like it all fits in the demonic character and therefore serves a very important cathartic release for people who live in a world where there are fairies in the woods and dragons on the edge of the maps and you know, instead of like gnomes in the forest. I mean, you have to remember, it's all of a part. That being said, as we're going to see when we get to Sefer HaSidim, I don't want you to walk away with this with the feeling that every Christian was out there both thinking that the Jews drink blood and aiming to kill them all. It's very important to remember that because the Jews were dispersed in small units, urbanization is taking place at this point, but slowly, it's just begun, right? That unlike later periods in European history, a lot of Christians actually not only knew but had personal relationships with Jews, and they shared a folk culture. So therefore, there was a tremendous amount, if not of sort of friendliness, but of a shared culture. And that's why these events tend to erupt. There's something about them, and I haven't, I admit, done the research to really get to the bottom of the periodicity, but there tends to be, in the same way that the nobles would periodically decide to discharge their debts through violence, it seems to be that there is a place for that fear to be discharged periodically through things like the blood libel. What drove it in particular places at particular times is each in its own sort of a measure. But this is another very important piece of the making of the Jew. Questions, comments before we get into the Tosafos and the Hasidim, Sefer Hasidim, and really the inner world of the Jew of the 12th century, 20th century. Whoops.
I just have one thing.
Please.
Question,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Certainly could have been, and that was the point I made before that you raised, is that it's not so hard to believe that the Jews would do such a thing if, A, you have evidence that they worship their martyrs who killed their children, and, B, you know that one of their primary rituals involves wounding their own child, and perhaps you may have seen this act, which involves, it looks like drinking blood. If people don't know what we're referring to, is that the moel, in traditional circumcision, uses his mouth to extract blood from the head of the penis. Right? It's, the Gemara names it as a medical thing. It's not a ritual thing. But nevertheless, it, up until recently, it was the universal practice. Sure, if the Christians knew the biblical stories if they couldn't read the Bible, so therefore that image was used. Not only that, but let's also be plain, is that the core in the Christians' minds, who know nothing about Judaism at this point, the average Christian knows nothing about Judaism as a religion, but they do know their Bible stories. And how does an Israelite worship their God in the Bible? Blood. Right, these are not unfounded concepts. And it's important to remember that in unfolding the story. What? Sacrifices, sure. This begins, and I'll close it with this, is that one of the primary Christian sort of knockout punches, as it were, after the destruction of the temple, when the debates between the Christians and the rabbis were still going on, is that it says in your Bible that in order to attain atonement, you have to give blood on the altar. What are you going to do now, Jew? You're stuck. Like, that's a real theological problem. You're stuck. Without the altar, your sins are just piling up. But I've got good news for you. Right? You know what good news is in Greek, right? Evangelist. I've got good news for you, which is his blood will make you clean. Which is a classic Christian phrase, which means that Jesus of Nazareth was the last sacrifice. Who comes to atone, this is why if you're familiar with Christian theology, comes to atone for all sins, because it replaces that. So therefore, whoever controls blood controls the gateway to atonement and therefore heaven. So that you have it in the communion, and so their assumption is that the Jews must have it too.
According to Christ.
Yes, specifically so. Yes, specifically so. Okay. Great. Well, that's a cheery topic. moving on. So there's kind of two sides to the inner world of Am Yisrael in Ashkenaz at this point. It's going to be the Tosafists and the Hasidei Ashkenaz. But to get a grip, a grasp, a picture of what they're doing, it might actually help to actually pull back the lens and address this notion of the other Jews out there in the world. If you looked at Spanish Jewry here in the 12th century, what you would find is a tremendous philosophical development, right? That it's focused on very familiar questions of rationalism, questions of being, essence, all the classic, either be it Platonic or Aristotelian, they broke down into different camps, but, you know, philosophical questions. The Gemara maintains its status as a halachic document. They certainly did not disparage the Gemara. But, you know, the ultimate development of the Gemara into a halachic document in Spanish culture, Spanish Jewish culture, happens in the hands of whom? No, that's much later. That's not... The Rambam, Maimonides, right? The Rambam writes the Mishneh Torah, right? It's published in the very end of the 12th century. It's quite the very end, but close to the end of the 12th century. And the Rambam says in his introduction is that all you need is my book and the Bible to live as a Jew, right? Buy my book, right? But don't undervalue the assertion there, which is that in the Rambam's mind, the halacha was a finite system. It was done now. He'd done it. He figured it all out. That's why the Rambam does not bring machloket, he doesn't bring controversy within his text, because he really believes, I figured it out, like it's done. This is the system forever, right? And that, it fits. Oh yeah, for sure. Right? And application is always relevant, right? There were no microwaves at Mount Sinai. We've spoken about this. But that's different than machloket. We'll get to the Tosfists and the different attitude. So maybe we'll understand that point from its inverse. But what I want you to take away from this is that it's a natural parallel to the philosophical mindset. Meaning if questions of being, essence, reality are philosophical questions, remember, philosophy finds its perfection in abstraction, right? Everything needs to work as an abstract conceptual framework. And reality, well, in Platonic philosophy, right, the perfection is the ideal. And reality is, there's this thing called horse. That thing you're trying to sell me is not quite what I'm looking for, thank you very much, right? I have an ideal. That's the reality. And the organic expression is always second best. Right? So therefore, the halachic system as a behavioral system is finite. It's true, the world will have to be applied, but it doesn't contain the infinite within it. Right? That's what's happening in Spain, which has its own consequences, and that's why in many ways that the Spanish Jews move much more quickly toward codification of legal texts. Because at a certain point, if there's a finite legal system, then let's just get it down. And that's it. This could not be further from the nature of the Jews of Germany and northern France. Right? They are living in a world where they've transformed the Talmud from a static into an expanding universe. And the way in which this happens is the reemergence of the dialectic. Right? What do I mean by the dialectic? There are three elements in dialectic thought. There's collation. I can do it without looking at my notes. No, I can't. Right? There's collation, contradiction, and distinction. Right? Meaning what? Collation, you bring all the pieces together. Contradiction, you figure out how they don't work with each other. Distinction, you make fine distinctions between them to actually figure out indeed how they do. Right? This is how the Gemara itself deals with the Mishnah in the Tannaitic sources. If you've learned some Gemara, then you know that the Gemara assumes that all the Mishnayot have to work, if not in perfect consonance, they have to be considered together. And so the Omoraim, the authors of the Gemara, are constantly saying, oh, well, this Mishnah says that, Well, how could that be? Doesn't it contradict them? Rebbe Meir, Kasher Rebbe Meir, Al Rebbe Meir, right? Rebbe Meir could have said both these things, right? That's collation, bring them together, contradiction, they don't work together. And what's the classic way the Gemara solves that problem? Yeah, with what we call an ukimta, right? We'll tell you that, oh, the case of the second one is actually distinct from the case of the first one, right? This is the method of the dialectic as it functions within text in general, right? It's a very powerful intellectual tool that in the demand, first of all, collation alone is a huge operating assumption that there is one thing here, right? And then this idea of identifying contradictions is a very powerful tool of how you distinguish things. And then distinction of the textual reading, of course, you know what else it can lead to? Is spurious distinctions. See, if the first assumption is not true, that everything actually belongs together, then what it ends up is with wild readings of a text in order to enforce distinctions. And if you've ever had this experience in the Gemara, you know what I'm speaking about. Because sometimes it's like, in order to reconcile two Mishnayot, the Gemara will tell you, well, actually, the case being considered here was on Friday afternoon, between the sixth and seventh hours, and only on the west side of the altar with a Kohen named Larry. Then I can tell you why Rebbe Meir would say these both things. Right? I can see some people nodding, right? This is obviously a silly example, but this is the power of what we call ukimta, of narrowing and narrowing and narrowing a case to the point in which you can resolve a distinction, which of course you created in the beginning by insisting that these two things should be reconciled. But what does it do is it pushes the text further and further away from what we would call a plain reading. You follow the power here? So we'll speak more about the problematics, but just for the first stage of understanding of dialectic, is that's why the Tosfos, as opposed to the Rambam, who said, okay, I finished, this is it, this is the picture. The Tosfos, you'll never be finished. The Gemara is no longer a text to be understood and mastered, but rather a problem to be constantly solved and engaged. Right? It is an expanding universe. Because the Tosfos now assume, like the Gemara, assume that every Tanaitic source had to be considered in relationship to every other one. The Tosfos will assume that every line of the Gemara has to be considered in relationship to every other. And that's why you get this phenomenon that we call in Yeshiva a Shas Tosfos. Right? There are certain Tosfot that on the page where you say, like, oh, that's interesting, Tosfot comments on that. And suddenly, they're telling you to look up eight different Masechtot in order to understand this line. And the first question that comes up is, well, why? Well, I don't have to look at all the other. The line here is embedded in this text right here, and I have a way. Rashi told me how to learn it. Rashi just told me to read the text and figure out what the line says. Tosfos says, well, but if you do that, you realize that it causes a problem over here, and it causes a problem over there. Right? The Gaonim, and culminating in Rashi, we're focused on a straightforward application and therefore understandings of the text. Right? Straightforward understanding and application of the text. That was their goal, and Rashi really is the culmination of that. That's why to this day, none of us can learn Gemara without Rashi. We don't understand what it's saying, and therefore we can't apply it. But the Tosfos were not interested in that. They turned the entire Gemara into question and resolution, in which case there is no end. And that's what I want you to take from this. And feel the energy. That's why I'm doing this with my hand. Is that the creative energy that bursts out of this culture. Now, who were the Tosfists? The first person we're going to identify one is Rabbi Yitzchak ben Asher, the Riva. He's an 11th century student of Rashi. Right? And he really introduces this dialectic method into Mainz and Regensburg. And it spreads quickly throughout all of Ashkenaz. Now remember, it's not a new method. It's a rebirth of something that basically stopped at around the 4th, 5th century. So that's important because it has instant legitimacy. I mean, you might think it's like everyone's going to say to them, who says you're allowed to do that with the Gemara? The Gaonim never did that with the Gemara. Rashi didn't do that with the Gemara. Well, the answer is, well, the Amoraim did it with the Gemara. Like, this is actually what we do. And for whatever reason, it's halted. And now think about it. Psychoemotionally, what's the appeal of suddenly discovering that the Gemara is infinitely large in all the contexts that I just described for you?
There's no sort of end to seeing you
Right? So therefore, it becomes an endless target of psychological, creative, emotional energy. I can pour my whole selfhood for generations into the Gemara. It provides an activity that educationally and culturally is ongoing and not just a product I deliver, but a process in which more and more people can engage. And this is the point at which Talmud Torah as a cultural phenomenon, the act of learning as a cultural phenomenon as opposed to as a practical need or an obligation, but rather as a cultural exercise, begins to be present. This is also, by the way, the age where individual authorship becomes far more widespread. Right? The Tosafists of, you know, Rabbeinu Tam, Tosafists of the Riva, people begin to publish, right? Which is a very important phenomenon, is pre-printing press. Right? What else? The Jew is locked in from every other direction to this point. I point out to you, the church has got us cornered. Right? In the economic system, we're being squeezed out of almost every area. You know, politically speaking, there's only one avenue, and that's our relationship with absolute power. Suddenly, the world opens up. And the human need for freedom should never be undervalued in any story. And it is, in fact, in many ways, I think, one of the most important shifts in Ashkenazi culture, the opening of the Gemara into an infinite space of exploration. This is the great age of exploration of the Jewish mind, right? And with it come all kinds of benefits and challenges, right? This is where, in my eyes, the original ghetto superstar is born, right? It sounds silly, but remember that the word ghetto, of course, is originally a Jewish word, and never forget that the only people for whom it's okay to culturally appropriate is the Jews. You try to claim ghetto as a Jewish word out there in the world today. Good luck with that one. The guy walking down the street in 14th century Paris, being spit on, pushed into the corner by the church, disempowered by the politics, you know, dirty money lending Jew. Inside, he's saying, I can turn the Gemara in knots, I can flip it over, untie, retie, I can show you horizons you've never even dreamed of. You can't hold me down. Right? That infinite space is not to be undervalued in terms of defining the Jewish experience in a tremendous time of oppression. It is almost identical, with the exception that the cultural social context in Babylon was one which was deeply welcoming to the Jews. Right? There were some rough periods, as we've spoken about, but nothing compared to what was happening here. So there's another very important piece is that as opposed to the Gaonic period, where really their focus was on I'm looking for the exact words to get it right, the sort of collation, preservation, conservation, explaining, applying, chidush, innovation, suddenly becomes a driving part of the Torah, which is very similar if you look at the Gemara, right? That you get that sense of excitement in the Gemara, where sometimes it's completely irrelevant, but just like a good chop in the Gemara, everyone's like, oh, Moshe, Shapira Kama, oh, Shinina, that was a good question, right? Does it matter? No, but it was a good question, you know? Right? And so that momentum comes back into culture here, and you can see how that both in terms of personal authorship, because the Tosafists start to produce their own, my Tosafos and these Tosafos. Rashi is sort of universal. Granted, I mean, we use his name, but Rashi goes with the Gemara like bread and butter. You wouldn't have one without the other, right? Whereas, like, oh, I got more to say. I've got more to say. You wrote Tosafists on that Masechet? I'll write them too and show you who's got the deeper insights. Chidush, personality, and ego all come into the world together. Did you have a question there? Comment.
Yeah, great. It sounds like the Rambam basically saying that Ken, what else was thinking, he would not be in favor of learning she can have 5, 10, 20 years, whereas the Tosafists, that's really the concept that's today sitting in forever.
Well, remember, the Rambam's ideal of divine service was right knowledge of God. Right, that his ideal of service was conceptual, not like intellectual conceptual, but in terms of cognitive. Right? If you want to know the best indication I can give you of what the Rambam's ideal was, look at the 51st chapter of the third section of the Moreh, of the guide to the perplexed, for the perplexed. And you'll see there that the Rambam's ideal is a philosophical, contemplative ideal, which is why it makes perfect sense that the Rambam's relationship to halakha is, let's just get everything in order to allow right consciousness to emerge. The Tosfos live in a chaotic universe. There's no end. There's no knowing. And what's going to happen, I'll get you in a second, what's going to happen, by the way, to Ashkenazi culture, we're now talking about 12th, early 13th century, right? What will happen is within about 400 years, depends on where you lay the marker, this culture will take another step upward in intensity into what's known as Pilpul, right? Because right now the quest is to actually understand the Gemara and nominally to apply it and reapply it, etc. Although the halacha and the act of learning Gemara are already beginning to diverge. But when the great law codes begin to be popular, the Tur in the 14th century, the Rosh and then the Tur, etc. So those law codes will now allow me to say, okay, great, now I know halacha l'maaseh, I know practical law, but there's still so much more to explore, and exploration for exploration's sake will become pilpul, which is like it's almost an acrobatic mental gymnastics, which if you've ever been in a high level like Achronos or Gemara Shiur and had that experience of like following the Rav, you're like wandering through this maze, you're not really sure, and then suddenly like, boom, right at the end. Anybody ever had that experience? Just pulls the line through and it's like, oh, this shining structure, which usually 5 minutes later you could not reproduce. But that moment is an incredible, you've had this experience, it's just an incredible experience and by the way, oftentimes it's an experience of what? Not the text, the teacher, right? And this is what's going to lead us directly into the Hasidei Ashkenaz, because the birth of ego in Ashkenazi culture is a very important element here, and the pietists will not be too happy with it. That's a good question. I would not say it's a negative reaction to the Rambam because I don't think that there was that much cultural overlap. There wasn't so much interplay. And the Tosfos philosophy was just unavailable to them because culturally it was unavailable. The church wasn't bringing it in. That was a product of Iberian culture. And also they lived, as we spoke about in previous classes, in a much more mythic universe, right? So the world is a mystery to them. The Gemara makes sense, it should be the same thing. There's no expectation that everything will actually fall into line. So perhaps the best known personality of the Tosfos is Rabbeinu Tam, right? Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Meir. He's the grandson of Rashi, born while Rashi was still alive, in the French city of Ramerupt, I don't know, in 1100. So it's a few years before Rashi dies. His mother was Rashi's daughter, Yocheved, right? There's all kinds of famous stories about Rashi's daughters. But his primary teachers were not his mother, although you never know. His primary teachers were his father, Rebbe Meir, and his older brother, the Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, right? So you just see that the intensity of the learning here was both amongst students and genetic descendants, right? The Tosfos were both the intellectual and genetic descendants of Rashi. And Rabbeinu Tam was recognized, and it's such a story that repeats itself, right? Recognized in early life for his mastery of the Torah, right? And his extraordinary intellectual capacity and character. Remember that he was given the name Tam. Tam means what in Hebrew? Simple, pure, whole. I mean, it's really an indictment of modern Israeli culture that to be Tamim today is a negative, right? It's like you're so naive. Like, ugh, is it Tamim, right? What? Yeah, Tom means many things, but the simple meaning is simple, right? But it's simple in the sense of whole, pure, sort of unblemished, as opposed to like the cynical, naive, right? And he's given that because Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Oalim, right? So he was a Yaakov, and his name was given to him apparently quite early in his life, and it was his intellect and really sort of personality, apparently had a very driving personality, that pushed dialectic study from the margins of the Beit Midrash and the Torah study where it began, right into the center. Right? Again, born in 1100, so the Riva precedes him intellectually, but culturally it's Rabbeinu Tam. who carries the dialectic into the heart of Torah. It's interesting that we don't actually have his writings. If you guys have learned Tosfos, you know that the only place you find Rabbeinu Tam is where he's referred to by the other Tosfists. His writings were destroyed, right? Which is unfortunately part of the story of the High Middle Ages that we'll speak about going forward. But just to give you a taste of personality here, so you can appreciate, there's a famous argument between Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi about the order of the Parshiot in the Tefillin. Whatever, there's four Parshiot. They have an argument about how they go. It's an argument shot in the Gemara. There's no reason to get into the details of it now. But the story goes that, now remember, could you imagine arguing with Rashi? Just think about that one. First of all, he was his grandfather, number one. Number two, he was Rashi, you know? But nevertheless, the story goes like this, that one night, Rabbeinu Tam had a dream. I don't know if he was already Rabbeinu Tam at this point, but right, he had a dream. And who came to him in his dream? No, not his grandfather. Moshe Rabbeinu.
Oh,
okay. Moshe Rabbeinu comes to him in his dream, and he says, Rashi was right. Yes. And what does Rabbeinu Tam says? Moshe Rabbeinu, you've made a mistake. So, again, is the story true? Who knows? Number one, they don't tell those stories about you and I, right? Number two, it is indicative of how his personality was perceived. Think about that for a second. That could be a story of a heretic. You had a dream. You saw Moshe in your dream. Moshe told you how the halacha ought to be, and you said, Moshe, you're wrong? Out of the Beit Midrash. No, you get the point of the power of the culture of the Tosfos, that innovation and the absolute confidence in the human capacity to know the divine will as expressed in the Gemara is at the center of this story. And it's very, I'm going to say it again, the human capacity to understand the divine will as expressed in the Gemara. Why is the human capacity element there so important?
But the Gemara teaches the same concept.
Absolutely.
The
Tanur of Achnai, right? God,
it's the exact same.
God says from heaven, don't you know that Rabbi Eliezer is always right? And the rabbis say back to you, get out of here, right? Okay, so I'm pointing out, this is not everybody do we tell those stories about.
Okay.
There are plenty of people in history who said, I'm right, God is wrong, and we say, you're not a Jew anymore, right? We know this story. So it is both at certain points in history, the culture is open to that, and it's also certain personalities, and it's also, of course, the proof is in the pudding, so to speak, meaning Rabbeinu Tam strengthened Am Yisrael. Like, always remember that. It's an important thing to when you want to figure out whether innovation is not only permissible but advisable. One of the challenges is, and I remember asked one of my rabbis when Shira Chadasha opened over on Emek Rephaim in the beginning, when it was radical in its day, or at this point they're like middle of the road, right? Yeah, they are, sorry. Depends on who you ask, right? And there are people who think I'm left wing. When I remember asking him about it, and it was an interesting conversation, but one of the things he said to me is that, well, you know, the real question is, will their children's children still be Yirei Shemayim? Meaning, I don't know if you know any of the people involved in starting that place, but the people involved in starting the place were real Yirei Shemayim. They had all kinds of opinions and problems and challenges like the rest of us, but they were real Yirei Shemayim. They weren't doing this for any reason other than this is the way we want to serve God. Right? And so the question that he said to me is that the real question here is, will their children's children or their students' students still be Yirei Shemayim? You know what the problem with that is? You can't answer it. Right. And so that this is always one of the challenges with innovation, is that it's not sufficient simply to do an analysis saying, well, you're breaking the rules. We don't do it that way. Therefore, we damn. Rabbeinu Tam just said no to Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? But history is littered with people who did that and fell by the wayside in the story. Or, God forbid, even took the story in directions which perhaps it ought not have gone. Nevertheless, the story doesn't go forward without those people. And this is a constant tension within a people that actually lives in an organic existence as opposed to philosophical. I mentioned that notion that philosophical existence, perfection, is found in abstraction. Organic thinking, its perfection is found in embodiment. Right? How do you actually live in the real world? And Rabbeinu Tam was able to harness the power of the intellect and this engagement of the human capacity to know the divine will within the context of the Gemara, where he was interested, in order to help Am Yisrael energize and embody itself in a very difficult period in history. Right? That the element of humanism there is important because the 12th century is also the birth of humanism within European culture. It's got its first seeds there. I mean, it has a much later flowering. And by humanism, it's essentially the focus on the human issues and the human capacities and the seeing of the human being as the center of creation as opposed to the divine will. And as much as I am deeply committed to the divine will, there's a big danger that divine will supplants the human being as the main character of the story, and therefore it leads to disempowerment and fatalism. The 12th century discovered that the human being is a very complex, powerful creature with vast capacities that had not actually been exposed up till now. And the Jews were part of that 100%. One of the major avenues that it took was into the intellectual sort of exploration of the dialectic through the Tosafos and the Gemara. And it produced, I mean, the Tosafos, I mean, what else can you say? It's an incredible, I just want to say it again, that they transformed the Gemara into something which could be ordered and understood and applied into an infinitely expanding universe which could be explored basically without end. What's that? Uh-huh. Very nice. It's Elohim Chaim because it's not an abstract philosophical assertion, but it's rather a lived, embodied life. And by the way, it's true it can only be black or white, but I've shown you guys this demonstration before, right? My art skills are limited, but hopefully you'll be able to see what we're looking at here. Right? Yeah, you couldn't. Do you think it was a chicken? Who said chicken? Right, what is this?
Okay. A horse designed by a comedian.
Stop it.
It's a pink elephant.
It's a pink elephant? No, it's half a pink elephant. You don't know what the other side looks like. Right, and that's the heart and soul of the dialectic. And it goes straight to the heart of this idea of Eluv Elu Divrei Elohim Chaim. Is that the human capacity, as large as it is limited by definition. We all have our perspective. And we can deal with that perspective by asserting that it is absolute. That's fundamentalism, right? Or we can deal with that perspective by engaging in dialectic, which is like, okay, tell me what you think, and I'll tell you how you're wrong, and you'll do me the same favor. Right? And in the context of those two sides, a more whole picture emerged. That's the heart and soul of Talmud Torah. Right? And certainly the Tosafos were engaged in that. Now, it comes at a cost. Before we get into the cost, and I'll make an intro to the Chassid Ashkenaz, who I can see we'll speak about next week. Sorry, 2 out of 3 is not bad, right? It's usually 1 out of 3. So after, sometime after Rabbeinu Tam told Moshe that he was wrong, Rabbeinu Tam, of course, lived through, just as his grandfather Rashi had lived through the First Crusade, he lived through the heart of the Second. And the story is told that the Crusader armies were massing to take their leave for the Holy Land on the second day of Shavuot. There's some reason, by the way, that the suffering of the Jews during the Crusades centered around Shavuot. My suspicion, by the way, is that it was seasonal, right? Meaning that you can't go to war in midwinter. It's just not, especially in Northern Europe, right? But as soon as things start to thaw, so like, you know, you're going to get underway. Nevertheless, there's something spiritual about the fact that on the second day of Shavuot, a group of Crusaders forced their way into his town, began to kill, and even though I said it wasn't a large-scale massacres, it's not like the Second Crusade was a roll in the hay for the Jews, right? And they broke into Rabbeinu Tam's house, they plundered all his wealth, and they wounded him 5 times, saying that it was in return for the 5 wounds that Christian tradition says, which Jesus received before the crucifixion. But the story goes on that the leader of the band was a French nobleman who had borrowed money from Rabbeinu Tam, right? And decided that this was a good opportunity to do 2 things. One is erase the debts. The other one was to make a great acquisition of soul by converting him to Christianity before he left for the Crusades. But Rabbeinu Tam refused and died a martyr at the hands of an anonymous crusader in the Second Crusade. Now, that's the way the story is told, and you can hear in it basically all the elements that we put into place about the making of the Jew, right? That these crusades, they came to him first for money, right? It was the conversion piece was an afterthought, but to the Jew, conversion at this point to a rabbinic leader like Rabbeinu Tam, right, is an unthinkable act even to feign to save your life, and therefore martyrdom is almost a natural end to the life of someone who was such a noble leader of his people. So there's a lot more that we could speak about in the Tosfos, but I just want to make sure that we're clear on who they were, and then I'll use that as a bridge into the Chassidei Ashkenaz. Yeah. There were,
at this period,
yes, exactly. The Tosfos that made it to Akko, also along with some of the students of the Ramban out of Iberia. And so maybe we'll speak about it. Maybe I'll bring that out because Eretz Yisrael is always worth keeping in the story.
I find it surprising that they lent money.
Why would you find that surprising that they lent money?
I don't think he's a teacher.
How do you think he had time to teach? It's unclear to me. You find it surprising morally? You find it surprising legally, character-wise?
Where did he get the money? Why was he even...
I don't know enough about his finances, but many of the Tosfos came from wealthy families. And that wealth, at this point in history, was often maintained through interest. In terms of the sort of moral legal question... it was, with some notable exceptions, who preached against lending money to the Jews. Against lending money to non-Jews. There are interesting voices amongst both the Rishonim and the Achronim you can find who identified it not as forbidden, but as very unwise and morally questionable. Nevertheless, the Torah permits it. Some readings, actually, the Torah makes it an active mitzvah to lend on interest to the non-Jews in order to sort of like harvest the value that's out there, so to speak, right? I can say that. No one's going to repeat that out there, are they? It was not an uncommon phenomenon. I don't know. I don't have that information at my disposal. But any other questions or comments on the Tosfos before we take the last 10 minutes or 7 minutes just to introduce Chassidei Ashkenaz? Nothing? That's it? So this last piece about sort of communal pride, right, this almost a collective sense, like I said, of this great age of exploration in Torah really lent an incredible psycho-emotional and creative energy to the Ashkenazi culture, and that power of chidush is very hard to appreciate unless you've tasted it yourself. Almost 700 years of pretty staid collection, commentary, understanding, application, to suddenly burst out with, like, I could say something that no one has ever said before, and that it could completely revolutionize the way that I understand Torah, etc. It is a very, what we call, like, a heady brew. And therefore, the danger of pride really lurked right behind. And so it's not a surprise that there was, in parallel to the culture of the Tosfos, a culture of pietists. A culture of Hasidim, right? Now, what is a Hasid? This is Chassidei Ashkenaz, right? If people aren't familiar, usually if you tell people, oh, I'm talking about Hasidim today, people associate it with the Baal Shem Tov and the Hasidic movement, which began in the end of the 18th century in sort of Eastern Europe. Yeah. Carpathia, Poland, it had a lot of names during those years. But there was an earlier phase of European Hasidim, right, who were Hasidei Ashkenaz, and this is we'll call them sort of late 12th, early 13th century. But before we get to them, because I only have a few minutes left, it's worth it just to pose the question, what is a Hasid? Because, of course, the term doesn't originate in the Baal Shem Tov, and it doesn't originate in Rabbi Yehuda Hasid, right? The Mishnah speaks about the Hasidim Rishonim, the early pious ones, and of course the word Hasid is a biblical word. So what is a Chassid. I think it will help us understand the culture that we'll actually map out in detail next week. What's the word chesed mean, first of all? So that's an application of chesed. An expression of chesed is to do good deeds. Loving kindness, right? Which is a posture. I would call it an emotive, psycho-emotive posture of chesed, but it's still not necessarily the thing itself. Oh, interesting. Another reference to the Hasidim are these sort of mystery people that come out of the woodwork and join the Maccabees in their initial victory in Jerusalem, which is a big question among scholars. Who are they? There's only two references to them in all the Sefer Maccabim. And I can send you a paper where people spill tons of ink trying to figure out. And it's very important to people who they are because they suspect a link to the early prophetic tradition. So there is this embodiment of chesed in Abraham, right? And then there's that classic phrase, chesed olam yibaneh, that you can read it as the world is built through chesed or chesed builds the world. Chesed is the unbounded inflow, right? Chesed is the unbounded inflow, right? And so that's the important, right? Chesed, of course, its companion is gvura. Gvura is the capacity to draw boundaries. And chesed is the unbounded inflow. Right, and that's why they work together, because, of course, if I want to give infinitely, you can't receive infinitely. You can only receive to the extent that you have a vessel to do it. Right? It's the edges of a cup that limit, but they also allow you to receive, because if it were a flat piece of plastic, anything I tried to give you would just overflow. Right? So because chesed is that posture of unbounded giving, what we're going to see is that the hallmark of Hasidim throughout the generations is the sense that what we have been given in order to understand the divine will is necessary but not sufficient. That just as the Tosafists took the text of the Gemara and with their operating assumptions of collation, contradiction, and distinction, transformed it into an infinite document and therefore an infinite exploration, Hasidei Ashkenaz will assume that there is something called the Ratzon HaBore. There is the will of the Maker. And that the will of the Maker finds its expression, of course, in the written Torah and, of course, in the oral Torah, just like the earlier Hasidim and just like the Hasidim after them. They were from, they were committed to the definitions of Halachic Judaism. But their sense was that the world was much bigger than that, and that it couldn't be that the will of God would limit itself to the dictates of the written and oral Torah. It must be that the will of God found its expression in everything, in everything. And therefore, the job of a chassid is to be able to determine God's will wherever it may be found. And so you can see already how this becomes what we would call a moral and devotional exploration, which has a direct parallel to the sort of intellectual legal exploration as embodied in the culture of the Tosafists. So that's just a thought to take away as you head out into your week, and we'll reconvene next week to talk about Hasidei Ashkenaz.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.